This is Cry Justice with Judy Redlich, examining issues of importance to you, your family, and our community that the other media just won't cover. Now, here's Judy Redlich.
What is it like to have a public defender's job? Well, we're going to be talking with a remarkable young lady, Cynthia Short. She's District Defender of the Western Division of the Missouri Public Defender's Capital Unit. She graduated from St. Mary's College in 1984 and received her J.D. from St. Louis University School of Law in 1987. She has two children, and she and her husband, Brian, who also practices law, is a trial attorney. They live in Kansas City. What is it like to be a public defender? What are some of the hard choices Cynthia has to make and the struggles that she goes through? Let's find out on this edition of Cry Justice. I'm Judy Redlich. Please stay tuned.
I am the person who is responsible for handling their case from the time that it is charged until it is resolved, either as a result of a dismissal, a plea, or a trial.
So when they come, when they get charged, you're the first one that has to tell them.
And when we do first get involved in the cases, the decision about whether the state is going to seek the death penalty or not has been made. There may have been something in the newspaper, but the client generally has not talked to anyone about the reality of that decision. There are some occasions where there really hasn't been any press coverage, but we've gotten a call that lets us know that the state is going to seek the death penalty. So we are the ones that are responsible for going in and talking to the client and to the family about the reality of that choice of the state, which can be I think for a lot of people, it's kind of another world, surreal kind of experience. I think for a lot of the clients, it takes a long time to even to be able to absorb the reality of that. And I think sometimes people, the clients and the families, never really do, which can be a problem for them throughout the whole case.
Or it happens right on the person's day of execution, doesn't it?
I think so. I think that, you know, it really is surreal to think about the state planning a day for your death. And I think most people believe and hope that there would be a better outcome in their case, that their case is different than the other cases, that they as an individual are worth saving. And they're right, but unfortunately the state doesn't always see it that way.
How does it make you feel, Cynthia, when you have to go in? And you know, do you get immune to it after a while?
No, I don't think you ever get immune. You're always, I'm always try to be prepared for what can be different reactions. By and large, the reactions have been silence. You know, maybe some questions afterward, but I really get the feeling a lot of times that, at least in that initial session, that even though you may be talking and trying to explain what this person might need to expect in the coming months and years, that they're not really hearing you at that time, that it really takes a lot of meetings and a lot of talking, and sometimes the use of videotapes, sometimes the use of clients who are already in Potosi or families who have been through this experience to help both the clients and their families, if the families are involved, understand the reality of the situation.
What percentage of families, Cynthia, are involved with their loved ones?
I would say probably half. I wouldn't say it's any larger than half. Obviously, a lot of our clients come to us after having been, a lot of them are older, which is takes away parents or aunts and uncles still being available to us. They may have traveled all over and really have a lot of people all around the country, which makes no one immediately available to them. And then there are others who simply have become estranged from their families. And then there's the other group where the families are very, very involved, there at every step of the way. And for the families, the difficulty is whether you're represented by a public defender or by a private attorney, is they're coming into a place that they are very unfamiliar with, and they don't really know what questions to ask or whether things are going the way they should be going or how they can help. And the answers to those questions may be as different or as unique as the case. But I think a lot of times families get frustrated because they never do get an answer to those questions until it's too late.
Many times you hear the myth that public defenders don't have time to do the research to
right.
properly represent the case. Is that true?
No. I think, frankly, the reality is it's the opposite. Missouri has been a good state in that we have decided to allow a specialized group of attorneys to be developed so that the attorneys that are doing the capital cases are attorneys who have been in the system or in the practice of law for a number of years. They've had a number of trials under their belt. They've been able to deal with lots of different clients and lots of different situations, and they've been able to go to all sorts of different training opportunities. And some of that is created by the attorney, how much they take advantage of. But since we are specialists, we are concentrating and trying to learn new things about this area and how to best present the client's position from every stage, from the moment we first walk into arraignment until the case finally finishes. And with these death penalty cases, it takes a lot of creativity to be able to persuade a jury, if that's where you're going to be, of the messages and the real truth of your case, or the prosecutors about the real truth of your client and why that person should not be on death row. So I do think that the public defenders, by and large, are working very, very hard. They are specially trained. They are concentrating in this area and no other, and they are not burdened by not worrying about not getting paid enough money to actually do a legitimate job. I have cases that have been reversed, and clients that have come back to us after being on death row, and every single client I've represented in that situation was represented by a private attorney.
Hmm. Maybe you can talk about some of the cases. You know, you hear when someone is on death row, very seldom do you hear that they are acquitted or they're found not guilty or they get a lighter sentence. What percentage of people who first get a death row sentence are acquitted or found not guilty?
Well, I don't know what the percentage is, but I do know that in research that's been done by different sociologists across the country, and in particular there's one study which has been put into a book which is called In Spite of Innocence. And in that particular book, they profile over 350 cases in this century where they can show that people who had at first been charged with capital murder or first-degree murder were eventually found to be innocent. There are other people that are on death row that we certainly suspect are innocent, but the proof may not be as easily obtained, or it might not be as clear-cut as some other cases. But what we have learned, or what I believe, Judy, is that we can't wait until the person is on death row to be finding that kind of evidence and fighting those kinds of battles, because there are so many roadblocks procedurally to doing justice. And so it is vitally important that those of us in my position are finding every way that we can to get to the truth and get the fairest resolution of the cases. And a lot of the clients who are charged are, in fact, innocent of the charge of capital murder or are innocent of the charge of first-degree murder. In other words, it could have been murder in the second degree or a manslaughter. And that has simply been overcharged.
And it's very hard, too, once they've gone through that initial trial and been found guilty, to appeal that and repeal it and get that sentence changed, isn't it?
Very, very difficult. In fact, there are cases where and people are familiar with in Missouri, the young man who was in prison for life, not on death row, who another person came forward and said, I'm the one that committed the crime. And Johnny Lee Wilson remained in prison under a life sentence until finally Governor Carnahan commuted his sentence or pardoned him, actually, and let him go. And that took a tremendous amount of effort, which really was more media-based than legal-based.
Right. You know, I have a question about Johnny Lee Wilson's case. It seemed like since then the governor has been, and this just may be my opinion, harder on making any changes in death row sentences.
But the politics get in the way, and they have been very careful about how they review the cases and what they do with them. And unfortunately, that, as we all know, is part of the problem with the death penalty, is that politics interfere with the correct outcomes, as they did, I think, in A.J. Bannister's case.
When you look at the psychological problems and the psychiatric problems that many, many of the people who have recently been executed, I've been following four or five of the cases, and out of those three, out of the five that I followed, had severe psychiatric problems, whether they had ADD, whether they had bipolar, whether they had some other psychiatric disorder, depression, manic depression. Can you address that?
Well, it's interesting that, at least for me, I have been really stunned, I guess, at some of the problems that people in our society inflict upon other people in our society. And I just finished reading a wonderful book called Guilty by Reason of Insanity by Dorothy Lewis, who is a psychiatrist from New York. And she addresses very, very well the trilogy of problems that we see with a lot of death row inmates, which include brain injury, low IQ, learning disabilities, some retardation, probably less of that than brain injury, and the brain injuries can certainly impact how we operate in the world. And the other part is environmental, how a person has been raised and in what type of environment they have been raised. And those things, those three things, can come together and do come together very often for our clients who find themselves on death row. Now, that's not to say that's true for every client, but it's true for many clients.
What about some of the new laws that are coming into effect? I know that people who have had psychiatric problems have not customarily been supposed to have been given the death penalty. Isn't that the case?
Well, you know, our state is particularly harsh on the insanity plea. We are, in fact, one of the most difficult states for have a finding of insanity for a client. And legal insanity versus insanity, as a psychiatrist or psychologist would define it if a crime was not involved, are really two totally different things. It is much, you may be psychologically ill, but not meet the medical definition, the legal definition of insanity. And that's a difficult thing for, frankly, me as a lawyer, as well as, I think, the public to understand. Of course, a lot of the public would say, look, anybody who kills somebody is insane at some level. And in Missouri, we are very, very obstructionist in allowing an individual who is clearly mentally ill at the time of the offense to receive treatment versus sending them to the penitentiary.
Right.
And what is very clear is, as a society, we have made the decision that if a person is incapable because of their mental illness to form the intent to form or to know the difference between right and wrong, we cannot punish the person for something they had no control of, but we do and should treat them probably for long term.
I'm Judy Redlich. You're listening to Cry Justice, and I'm interviewing Cynthia Short. She's District Defender of the Western Division of the Missouri Public Defender's Office. She works in the Capital Unit. That means she works mainly with death row inmates, telling them their sentence and helping them all the way from the trial stage all the way to whether they're acquitted, their sentence is stayed, their sentence is made lighter, or they receive the execution. This is Cry Justice, and I hope this is helping to dispel some of your myths about how well the public defender tries to help those people who need their assistance. I'm Judy Redlich. Again, you're listening to Cry Justice. And let's go back to Cynthia.
The person that you were talking about who had his execution stayed, right after that, he received his first psychiatric evaluation. Also, Reginald Pollard, whose execution was stayed. He had not had a psychiatric evaluation until after they stayed his execution. Now, how can they answer to that?
Well, and here we go back to the work of the original lawyer, and the training of the original lawyer. There are and have been lawyers who have handled cases at the trial level who have said things such as, I do not believe in psychological defenses. I don't believe that juries give any weight to what a psychiatrist will say. And therefore, before they ever really start looking into the situation or considering who this human being is and what has happened to this person, the lawyer, through no fault of the client, the lawyer has started shutting doors and said, I'm not going to look at this for various reasons. I don't have enough money to look at it. The client doesn't want me to look at it. I don't think it'll do me any good in the arguments that I'll make to the state about how to resolve this case, or I wouldn't present it to a jury because it's meaningless to the jury. And all of those arguments are misplaced. They are wrong. And unfortunately, as a result of a combination of problems at the trial level, a lack of training, a lack of money, a lack of understanding about how to present psychiatric or psychological testimony to a jury, and a lack of understanding about how those components came together as with part of the other circumstances that might have led up to the crime, to give us an explanation about why something happened. And if you simply start from the very beginning with a closed mind about psychiatrists, psychologists, and what they might be able to show you, then, in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, you're really doing a disservice to your client. And that's why we hear horror story after horror story about lawyers not presenting evidence during the penalty phase, or lawyers never discovering that their client had such a significant brain injury that it showed up on an MRI exam or on an EEG exam. And so then the lawyers who have represented these people do look bad, and in fact these lawyers didn't properly represent their clients, in my opinion.
What tips do you give to people who have a loved one on death row? What can they do? How can they help the attorney or even someone who is maybe in a pretrial phase? How can they best help their attorney?
Well, I think that they can do a combination of things. They can help the loved one by being involved. And being involved can mean going to visit. It can also mean making yourself available to the attorneys and really searching through your own experiences, your family experiences, and be willing to talk about those things. We can only do what we know, and what I mean by that is I have to know everything about that client, the good stuff, the bad stuff, the neutral stuff, in order for me and the people that I might hire to help us to really evaluate what was going on with this client. And that can be a very, very hard thing for the family. But if they want to help, they have to be willing to get involved that way. I think they also, depending on the circumstances, they need to be willing to, particularly if they hire a lawyer. When you hire a lawyer, that person is working for you. And if a lawyer won't take your calls, if a lawyer will not meet with you, if it's been months and months and months and you've never talked to that lawyer about the background of your loved one, then you need to reconsider that lawyer as the best lawyer for your son or daughter. And so often I have heard stories after the fact, after the conviction, the family will go back and they will have learned a lot about the process and a lot about what they should have done. And they, I think, really beat themselves up about not asking questions early enough or not recognizing the problems. But I think we have a tendency when we hire a lawyer to think, well, you know, they know what's best, they'll do what's best, I shouldn't ask any questions, I shouldn't bother that person. In my opinion, you should. And if they will not talk to you, or they won't return calls, or you're not satisfied, then you should take action.
Maybe many of us have the misconception that everybody who is on death row receives the execution. Can you give us some positive or some success stories about how people have been acquitted?
Well, I have. In the last year, I have had the pleasure to represent three individuals who were all charged originally with murder in the first degree. Two of them also, aggravating factors were filed against them. In other words, the state wanted to seek the death penalty. And when I talk about working through the case, and our work is very important, the first thing we want to do always, no matter what the facts of our case are, is we really want to be fighting to get the state to waive the death penalty. So the issue of our client ever getting on death row is removed before any trial ever takes place. And in these three cases, and in the two where they sought capital punishment, we were successful in that before we ever got to trial. The state had waived the death penalty, and it was a combination of different things that led to that result. But once we got into the courtroom, and again, through a lot of work, which took a lot of time, I think on average these cases were 2 years old, we were able to demonstrate to the jury that these clients were not responsible for, in any way, the deaths of the people that were involved in those particular cases. And all three of those individuals in this last year were acquitted, one in mid-Missouri and two here in Kansas City.
When you look at the overpopulation of our prisons and how across the nation people are saying, let's build more prisons, let's lock people up, it becomes not only a lucrative business for those seeking jobs, but also an escape from some of the reality that's really happening across our nation. Would you like to comment on that?
Sure. I have found it extremely upsetting, I think, in the last few years that we as a community have misled the public into thinking that they can be safe if we would just build more jails, have more spaces to warehouse more people. And where we obviously need to be spending the money is to help individuals before they ever get into this situation be the best that they can be. And we need to obviously be putting our money into programs that are treatment-based, into programs that are educationally based, and programs that will assist families who are troubled because of their experiences over the years, not to destroy those families, but to help them survive and to break through any cycles of violence that they have lived through. And it is, I think, extremely short-sighted of us to think that we can simply just lock people up and warehouse them away, and that that will solve the problems, that that will protect us. And we have certainly seen over and over and over that that is not true.
With the political tenor of our nation as it is, what do you think it's going to take to see that change?
Well, I think that, unfortunately, the minority of the media understands and is willing to approach these issues in a fair and broad-based way. Unfortunately, what we get in this society that's driven by sound bites, we get one-third of the information that the media or someone wants us to know, and we are left without a lot of information that would completely change our minds about things. And I see that over and over and over in trial cases where the media has painted a picture of a particular case in such a way that is so prejudicial, but also, only one quarter true. And I think until there are people who are willing to get involved in the media, in the mainstream media, who can present a broad-based picture of the reality of this stuff, not once, not twice, but over and over and over, that the public will remain really ignorant about the realities of what we're doing.
Well, I've been talking with Cynthia Short, and she's an attorney. She's a district defender of the Western Division of the Missouri Public Defender's Capital Unit in Kansas City. And really, I didn't realize that they had set up special units in Missouri to just help with the capital punishment cases and how public defenders are really trying to find as much information. Can you believe how much it must take, how long of a period it must take to find out everything you need to know to represent someone in their trial phase, even who might be convicted to do a life sentence or have or be scheduled for death row? You know, it's really something, and we need to pray for the public defenders, not only in the state of Missouri, but across the nation. We need to pray for attorneys who are representing people on the private level. We need to realize that Jesus Christ is giving us, as we're learning more about the legal system, insights into what to pray for and what to do and how to help people maybe who are our loved ones investigate their cases. And we need to be an active people. We can't just sit back anymore. In our Christian witness, going to church on Sunday, that's really not enough. We need to witness for Jesus Christ. We need to pray that God will give us the boldness that we need to be the witnesses that He wants us to be so that we can be the salt and the light and not the compromise. Well, I'm Judy Redlich. Hope you've been enjoying this edition of Cry Justice. Hope you'll tune in next week for another edition of Cry Justice. If you have topics that you'd like us to cover, we'll be glad to consider them. Justice issues right here on Cry Justice. And tell your friends to tune in each week to Cry Justice, heard on this station. Thanks again for tuning in. Again, this is Judy Redlich, thanking you for joining me for this edition of Cry Justice.
Email me at jredlichspeaks@att.net.